Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Stefan Bauer. Stefan teaches early modern history at Warwick University, and he's the author of a brilliant new book, The Invention of Papal History, Onofrio Panvinio Between Renaissance and Catholic Reform, just published by Oxford University Press. Stefan, congratulations on the book, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Crawford, for inviting me.
Well, thank you for your time today. Before we begin to talk about this really important new book, The Invention of Papal History, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. I think in order to understand how the book came about, I need to say a little bit about my background. I'm from Germany, so I studied history in Germany, but I already sort of took three different roads at the same time because during my undergraduate, I also did a junior year abroad in Cambridge at Corpus Christi College and an Erasmus study period in Italy. And then for my postgraduate studies, I went to London again to a research institute, which is the Warburg Institute, which also combines sort of the tradition of German scholarship and Italian scholarship, but being placed in London. And I did my PhD there as well. And after my PhD, and I say a little bit about what I did later, after my PhD, I went to Italy to a research institute, which is the German Historical Institute in Rome, which also combines, you know, the German tradition of scholarship with study of Italian history. In fact, it was opened when the Vatican archives were opened in the late 19th century. And after that, I went and I worked at the Italian-German Historical Institute in Trent in North Italy, which is also works on the relationship between German scholarship and Italian scholarship. And then I came back to England and I've been teaching at different universities in England. I've been teaching in London. I've been teaching at University of York. Royal Holloway, and now currently I'm teaching at University of Warwick.
Now, can you tell us a little bit more about the background to this book, Stefan? You mentioned at the beginning that this project is a smaller version of some other work that you've done in this area.
Yes.
And of course, you've been publishing in this area for a very long time.
Yes, I have. So I've always been interested in the history of historiography. It's not always been Renaissance historiography. So my first book project was on a historian who's famous for his history of the civilization of the Renaissance in Italy, which is Jakob Burckhardt, the 19th century Swiss historian, who also wrote a history of Greek civilization. So that was my first book project, the reception of Greek democracy in 19th century historical thought. And I then moved to the Renaissance when I went to the Warburg Institute, which is sort of concentrates on Renaissance studies. And I worked on papal history in the earlier Renaissance, in the 15th century. And that was my second book, which was about the papal biographer and historian, the humanist Bartolomeo Platina, who wrote Lives of the Popes. which he finished in 1475 and presented to the reigning pope at the time, Sixtus IV. And what Platina did was that, being a humanist, he was very keen on improving the elegance of the Latin language. So when he looked at what had been written about the popes before him, which was the medieval Book of Pontiffs, the Liber Pontificalis, as it's called in Latin, he decided that he had to transform his source into a more elegant version of papal lives. So I studied how he did that, which other sources he also consulted in order to create a narrative. And I found out that he's interesting because he uses, you could say, a non-ecclesiastical sources, which he also brings into the story of the papacy. He uses ancient biographical models, but he's also critical of the moral corruption of churchmen. So that was a sort of a reforming trend within humanism at the time. And I found it really interesting that that was possible, to say, in the 1470s in Rome, right under the sort of under the eyes of the reigning pope, and presenting the book to him while at the same time criticizing the morals of low and high churchmen. And in fact, the other thing I found in my studies when I went into Roman archives, especially the archive of the Inquisition and the archives of the Congregation for the Index of Prohibited Books, those were institutions that were created in the 16th century, I found that the editions of Platina's Lives from 1560s onwards were censored. So my book, my second book, is called The Censorship and Fortuna of Platina's Lives of the Popes in the 16th Century. And this leads me to the book on Panvinio, but did you want to say something, Crawford?
No, I was just going to comment how neatly that took us to a discussion of Onofrio Panvinio. Could you tell us who Panvinio was and why he matters?
Well, I first came across Panvinio because he was the editor of Platina's Lives of the Popes in the 16th century. So he brought out an updated edition, where he continued the papal lives. So Platina obviously stops in 1475, and Panvinio brings him up to date with the descriptions of the lives of the succeeding popes until the 1560s. So that's how I came across him, and I found out that very little work had been done on him. So I went to see who he was. Panvinio was an Augustinian friar, which is the same order that Martin Luther came from, incidentally. So his order had come into a little bit of disrepute in the early 16th century, and there were some reforming generals of that order who tried to impose sort of stricter communal life onto the order. So Panvinio came from Verona. He was born in 1530, and he went to study first in Naples and then in Rome in the institutions within the Augustinian order, which allowed friars to study philosophy and theology. That was the usual course of study. Much more philosophy than theology, because that was the foundation they studied. But he had this passion for history, and he says since he was a teenager, it's not something that you could study at university. It's a passion he developed on the side while he was studying philosophy and theology. And then, because he had protection from sort of higher in the higher spheres of the Augustinian order, he was asked to work. His first work was a collaboration on the history of the Augustinian order, starting with what they claimed was Saint Augustine, which now we know it's a legend, because the order was actually formed in the Middle Ages, but not at Augustine's time. And then he devoted himself to studying ancient Rome, pagan ancient Rome. So that was his passion, antiquarianism. He was part of a group of scholars, which we refer to as antiquarians in the 16th century, in the middle of the 16th century. So he worked on the institutions of the Roman Empire, commentaries on the Roman Republic. He worked on ancient Roman calendars, calendars of lists of office holders, fragments of which had been discovered in the Roman Forum, and scholars were now at work putting these fragments together and interpreting the chronology of these office holders, which gave them an idea of the chronology of ancient Roman history. But what happened in the 1550s, there was a sort of shift in emphasis at the Curia, and the people that Panvinia was involved with convinced him to put aside his studies of ancient pagan Rome and to devote himself to the study of church history. And a man who was instrumental in this was Marcello Cervini, who was a cardinal, who then became librarian of the Vatican Library and then became pope, but was pope only for a few days before he died. But he was responsible for Panvinio's turning from ancient pagan history to church history. Panvinio then had to look for new patrons, and he found another very important patron in Cardinal Alessandro Farnese, who was a cardinal living in Rome, not always, but generally living in Rome. And he was the wealthiest cardinal of the Roman Church. There was a group of scholars sort of circling around him. Panvinio was the most important historian, but there were other types of scholars as well. For example, Giorgio Vasari says that his idea of writing Lives of the Artists was born at a dinner, you know, at the dinner table of Cardinal Farnese, where he was there with other scholars. Panvinio then wrote, many things he wrote were books that were written for the first time. So he wrote the first history of cardinals. And in fact, when other scholars then later worked on history of the papacy, this was the book they could refer to. It was the only book on the topic at the time. He wrote the first history of papal elections, and it was also the largest history of papal elections that has ever been written until today, is what I found. He also worked on the iconography of medieval popes, trying to reconstruct how they were depicted, what their vestments were. He researched catacombs and ancient burial rites. He worked on descriptions of medieval churches. So he's now being used as a source for art historians and many other things until he died in 1568. So he died when he was 38 years old of a fever. We don't know what kind of fever. Suddenly, when he was traveling to Sicily with the cardinal, and he died in Palermo on the Wednesday before Easter in 1568, which I found.
Mm. So in many ways, his life was steeped in the work of historical scholarship, wasn't it? Your book brings this out really beautifully. But what was the status of historical writing in Panvinio's youth? You mentioned before this was not something he could be educated into. It had to be a matter of private study.
Yes, history was not taught at Catholic universities until 1742, so not for 200 years after that. So he became a historian, and he had a special privilege to work as a historian, because friars were expected to chant in the choir or to beg for alms. Friars who had academic titles were to some degree exempt from these some of these duties, but he had a very special privilege because he was allowed to live outside of his Augustinian house and to live with the cardinal and to work as a historian basically 24 hours well, they say he almost worked 24 hours a day, but this is what he did. So he was one of the few full-time historians at the time. What's also interesting that at the time, I said that he worked as an antiquarian, working on ancient Rome, but he also worked on church history. Now, the circumstances were very different, because if you worked on ancient Rome at the time, it was much more sort of the church didn't really get involved and with what you were writing, because you were writing about a pagan past. Whereas if you were writing on church history, you could get in trouble with the censors, and that's what he did. So why was church history so important at the time? So, you know, so I'm trying to differentiate between what different kinds of history we're talking about. Church history was contested from the beginning of the Reformation onwards. So from sort of the earliest debates that Luther was involved in, and I always refer to the 1519 disputation in Leipzig, where Luther debated with a Catholic theologian named Johann Eck about the papal primacy. Papal primacy was the idea that the Roman Pope had universal authority over all other bishops, and he could even have the right to depose emperors. So Luther did his research in order to prepare for that disputation, and he came to argue that papal primacy was an invention created by the church hierarchy in the last few centuries, and it was not of divine origin. So that this was one of the few few moments where Luther actually ventured into church history. But you can see from that debate how history was important in the debates between Catholics and Protestants when they debated about which was the right church. Was it the Protestant church, which was now recreating sort of the early apostolic church, or was it the Catholic church, which had maintained its traditions throughout the Middle Ages? And for both, you needed history in order to make your points.
So could you tell us a little bit more about how history then relates to confessionalization in the 16th century?
Yes. So if you think about the church traditions, many of these were upheld by Catholic historians who argued that these went back to apostolic times. And it was very important to realize that very often there was a gap in that tradition, and that concerns the first period after the apostolic time until sort of the medieval period, where a written tradition becomes more continuous. And here, very often it becomes a matter of faith if you believe that the tradition was actually carried through from apostolic times to the Middle Ages. And this concerns even the very series of popes, the continuity of the pontificates. And why is that important? Because authority was passed on from Christ to St. Peter to the first popes, and then in a continuous line from one pope to another. So if that line was ever broken, the present pope, the pope in the 16th century, whom we're actually discussing, could not claim that his authority derived from the apostles. So Protestants did everything they could to attack this apostolic succession. One of the stories, for example, that was used for that purpose was the story of Pope Joan, which is known to many people even from cinema, from films, from novels, which is the legend that in the 9th century there was a female pope who dressed up as a man and then died in childbirth while on a procession in Rome. Now, if that story was true, then the apostolic succession was interrupted. So Panvinio, again, he's the key man in that discussion. He proves that the story was false. He proves that there was no contemporary source which actually mentioned that source. There was no reliable source that actually mentioned that legend for several centuries, whereas Protestant historians, the authors of the so-called Magdeburg centuries, which is the big Protestant church history, argues that these sources have been suppressed because, and they say, and I'm quoting, because she was a woman and because of the scandal. So, but these arguments could also be turned around depending on your confession and depending how you wanted the story to evolve. So people were researching historical evidence, but historical evidence also was, I would say, manipulated sometimes in order to fit within overarching, you could say, political priorities or theological priorities. It was very often theologians who defined what could be said and what was censored. And I think that's something we'll talk about later as well, I hope.
So he lived this really abundant life in scholarship, but what happened to Panvinio's legacy?
Yes, so Panvinio died in 1568. He had been appointed to a position in the Vatican Library in 1565 by Pope Pius IV, but his relations with the succeeding Pope Pius V had worsened. And in fact, when Panvinio died in 1568, this pope didn't lose much time before he actually decreed that Panvinio's works could not be printed and could not be reprinted. There were lots of manuscripts which were waiting to be printed and other works were waiting to be reprinted. And this is because this pope, Pius V, was quite a strict Catholic reformer, and Panvinio was trapped between different reforming currents. Pius IV was a more relaxed reformer. Pius V was a stricter reformer. So he would have had to change his writing style according to which pope was actually reigning at the time. So Pius V prohibits the reprinting of his books. His manuscripts are kept locked up, and they are kept at the cardinals' houses, a succession of different cardinals, while his brother, Paolo Panvinio, is trying to get his works printed because he wants to profit from the publication. He wants to make money. So he spends time lobbying cardinals in Rome. And in the 1580s, they finally managed to print one book, which is on the primacy of Peter, and only the first part of that gets printed in 1589. But then there's a commission in 1592, which decides that they needed to look at all of his manuscripts. So they opened these trunks, and they found 87 works, in manuscript works, and that's why I call sort of the corpus of his works, I call the invention of papal history. That included also a history of the church, which wasn't published, and various other works, including the history of papal elections, which I mentioned earlier. And these were then censored. It was not the only time that they were censored, but this commission also censored his works. And I find it very interesting to see what the mentalities of these censors were, what their relation to history was, and what they found offensive. So, for example, the 1592 commission found that Panvinio criticized morals of churchmen, and that was actually something he inherited from his humanist predecessors, from Platina, for example. So they thought that couldn't be permitted. they thought that he was actually on the side of the emperors, taking the sides of the emperors in the conflicts between in the power struggles between popes and emperors in the Middle Ages. He admitted that emperors could have influenced papal elections. And Panvinio even said in one of his works, what I'm going to write is not going to please the Christian reader. And his censor thought that this was an admission of his guilt. But what Panvinio actually wanted was something else. It was kind of like a trigger warning for the distressing sources that he was going to cite. But these were sources that were documenting actual practice at the time, and the fact that emperors had influenced papal elections was a historical fact.
That's fascinating.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned that this is the first substantial work in Panvinio for over 100 years, I think. What do you hope the impact of this book will be?
Well, there was a biography about Panvinio from 1899, so this is the first biography, and it's the first study of his works on church history. There was a book on his works on ancient Rome published in 1996 in French by a scholar named Jean-Louis Ferrari, who unfortunately just died a few months ago. But I was trying to fill a gap, and that is what happened to Catholic historiography in the middle of the 16th century, because Protestant historiography at the time has received much more attention. So I think in the public's view, it is believed that sort of modern historical method was invented by Protestants and much less so by Catholics. And so that's one aspect I want to bring out, so that there was an open and creative phase of Catholic history writing at the time as well. And I'm talking about the middle of the 16th century, before the first volume of Cesare Baronio's his Ecclesiastical Annals came out in 1588. And that was then the official Catholic history, which was very different from Panvinio's work, much more dogmatic, much more confessionalized. So I'm interested in that creative period before that. And I'm also hoping that my book will, readers will be able to read my book in different ways. It's not very obvious that sort of I'm trying to justify what the Catholic Church was doing, or I'm trying to justify the opposite. I think what Panvinio was doing was he was idiosyncratic. His work could be read by Protestants as somebody who was trying to sort of not lean to either side. And I think it can be read by Catholics in the same way too. So I'm hoping that my book is also able to sort of to manage that balance.
Well, it's a brilliant book, Stefan, and it deserves a very, very wide readership. The Invention of Papal History, Onofrio Panvinio Between Renaissance and Catholic Reform, just published by Oxford University Press. Before we wind up our conversation, Stefan, could you tell us what you're working on at the moment?
I'm working on at the moment, I've been writing another article on the reception of the Liber Pontificalis, and there was a myth that was propagated by Platina and Panvinio that the Liber Pontificalis had been written by Anastasius the Librarian, which was a medieval diplomat, and how that myth came about, which is not true. I'm just publishing an article on that. But my next project is going to be about forgeries, in church history, and especially late antique and medieval forgeries, and how they were discovered to be forgeries in the early modern period, and again, and how they were became part of these confessional discussions. So at the same time, we have scholarship exposing forgeries, and we have theologians or other members of the church arguing that they were not forgeries for quite a while, even though they had already been exposed. And I found that transitional period so fascinating. So that's something I'm working on now.
That sounds wonderful. Hopefully we can get you back in the show sometime when that comes out to talk about it. That would be great. Well, Stefan, thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it. And thank you for taking the time also to write this book and for being willing to talk about it, The Invention of Papal History, just published by Oxford University Press. And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.